Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday media roundtable, and with the U.S. Supreme Court kicking off its new term this week, we brought in some expert court watchers to guide us through some of the most important cases on the docket. The court is likely to address executive power in numerous significant rulings as Donald Trump attempts to expand his presidential authority. There are also cases related to LGBTQ rights, immigration, and elections, just to name a few issues. And if you're wondering, if the Supreme Court was on summer break, why have I been reading so much about it recently? Well, the so-called emergency docket was flooded with important rulings the past few months, which kept the Supreme Court in the news. And we're going to unpack some of those and what the likely future is for this pattern of out-of-term decisions. Is this going to be a new normal? So joining us to break down all of these issues and what to expect from the Supreme Court's term this year, we're joined by a couple of guests with deep knowledge of the court. First, I want to welcome Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork. The website is a great resource for keeping up with the Supreme Court and other important legal developments across the country. So, Chris, welcome back to Your Call.
Thanks so much, Ethan.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation. He's the author of two books, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America, and Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie, welcome back to Your Call.
Thanks for having me, Ethan. Great to be on with Chris. I am a subscriber on Substacks to Law Dork.
Absolutely. We recommend everyone who cares about the courts and the judicial branch to subscribe to Law Dork. Wonderful to have both of you with us here to break down what we can expect with this upcoming Supreme Court term. But first of all, it is our Friday media roundtable, and we have a tradition of asking our guests to shout out a good piece of journalism that you've seen lately. So what's something that you've read, heard, or seen in the past week that you've liked or want to recommend? So Ellie or Chris, I'll let either of you jump in with that.
Go for it.
I read the Radley Balco piece, kind of connecting the dots between the war on drugs to the war on terror to Trump murdering people in a PT boat in the Caribbean. And he really draws, he shows how that line is a linear progression of violence and terrorism by this government. And I think it's an important piece that everybody should read.
All right. And Chris, sounds like you were going to jump
in.
Yeah,
I've been really thrilled. I think one of the great things about covering the national legal landscape is that I get to see, as new cases arise, what state and local reporters are doing across the country. And this week, due to Trump's overreach that I'm sure we're going to be talking lots about over the next hour, I've had the chance to read a lot of John Seidel's work at the Chicago Sun-Times this week. He's their federal courts reporter, and he's just done a great job of covering the mass of both challenges to Trump and the Trump DOJ's handling of and dismissing of and no bill of charges against protesters in the Chicago area.
All right. Well, we appreciate the shout out to those two pieces of journalism and those two journalists. Always great to have some recommendations and highlight the good work that's happening in the media world. And now let's move on to the Supreme Court. And before we get into specific cases, just want to set some context here. Now, Chris, you recently wrote that this term could, quote, fundamentally challenge the balance of powers in America, all but eliminating the separation of powers that were purportedly essential to the so-called genius of America's Constitution. Chris, can you just say more? Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I think we saw at the beginning of the Trump administration, the second Trump administration, and certainly over the summer, this idea that wherever there is a an opening for the Supreme Court's Republican appointee majority to allow Trump to act, that they have said go ahead in ways that ultimately have the effect of diminishing, if not just cutting out entirely, the role of the legislative or judicial branches.
Yes, and Ellie, your cover story in The Nation, I think, touches on a similar theme. You summarize this year's term with a piece titled "The Supreme Court versus Democracy." And you wrote in that piece, I'll quote, "Nobody should be under any illusion that this court will stop or restrain Trump in any meaningful way this term." So can you maybe build on what Chris is saying there? Are we really in a situation where the Supreme Court is really just empowering the executive branch to, you know, really run roughshod in a way over the other branches of government and other, and the states as well, as we can get into with some of these cases that we'll talk about?
Yes, the Supreme Court is primed to let Trump run roughshod over anything approaching the normal operation of law or justice or fairness. And they've been doing this for some time. I think one problem that a lot of people have, a lot of institutionalists have, a lot of centrists have, and certainly a lot of liberals have, is the idea that the Supreme Court is some kind of apolitical institution, that it is some kind of bastion beyond and above the political fray, that is our last line of defense, our ultimate guardrail against the authoritarian takeover of this country by MAGA and Donald Trump. And that is just not true. And I don't know how many times the Supreme Court has to basically get out there and prove that it's not true before people get it. The Supreme Court is a handmaiden to the authoritarian takeover of the government by MAGA and Donald Trump. They are helpers in that. They are his enforcement wing, and they give his flatly illegal and unconstitutional ideas and policies the false imprimatur of law, the false imprimatur of authority, right? Like, so they literally act to normalize the weird and wild and crazy and illegal things that Trump does. These people have debased themselves in service of Trump and MAGA, and they will absolutely continue to this term.
And this is part of a long-standing effort, though, by conservative, you know, legal thought, right, to empower the executive branch, the unitary executive theory. Chris, maybe let you weigh in on that. I mean, can we put this in some sort of context here, where we've gotten to the point where the supposedly small government, you know, conservatives are very much in favor of very strong executive authority?
Yeah, I mean, I think the perfect example that we've been seeing over the course of this year, and particularly over the summer, is the way that the court handled various efforts by Trump to fire people for no reason when the laws establishing those roles, passed by Congress, signed into law by a prior president, and upheld over the years by the Supreme Court, require that the president can only fire those people for cause. And they tend to be what the Supreme Court had allowed for the past 90 years, is that particularly when you had multi-member agencies, specifically like the Federal Trade Commission was the case at issue, that when you have that, there's a reason why Congress wants to make it more difficult for the president to get rid of that person, because mm-hmm. they are sort of these multi-member bodies that have a role outside of the day-to-day governing of politics. And what the Supreme Court has done over the course of this summer, without hearing a single case on the merits yet, is essentially overturn that 90-year precedent by allowing on the shadow docket Trump's firings to go into effect that plainly contradict that 1935 ruling called Humphrey's executor without so much as a decision on the merits. They're not going to be hearing that case until later this term. And that's what brought us to the crisis point with Trump attempting to fire a member of the Federal Reserve Board.
Yes, Elliot, it sounds like you want to jump in there.
Let me just jump in here, because I also, like, we need to start understanding that the conservative press releases about what they are doing judicially and what they want their judges to do has always been a lie. All right? They never were concerned about judicial restraint. That was a lie. They were never concerned about small government. That was a lie. They were never concerned about originalism or textualism, because every single time originalism or textualism spits out an answer that the conservatives don't like, that doesn't help them in their ongoing culture war, guess what they do? They throw out originalism and textualism and go with something else. So the entire conservative legal establishment is based on a lie. And if we don't start calling these people out for these lies, if we continue platforming people who are going to go on media and continue to lie about what they're doing, we're never going to get anywhere, right? These people are lying. Their justices are lying. When these people sit for confirmation hearings, they lie to the face of the American people and Congress. They are lying. And like that is an important, I think, rubric to understand, because it shows the futility, and this is why I'm bringing this up, it shows the futility of arguing with them, right? Mm-hmm. And again, centrists, institutionalists, a lot of liberals think that you can argue your way out or through or around this Supreme Court by using their own logic, right? And if you don't understand fundamentally that their logic is based on lies, then you have the false sense that you can argue your way through it. You can't argue your way through it, because as soon as you trap them in their own logic, they'll lie about something else. They'll make something else up. Facts and argument are no more use here in front of this Republican Supreme Court.
Well, Ellie, so what you're saying is that basically they're going to use whatever convenient sort of ideological excuse to try to get to a certain set of policy outcomes. And maybe it's states' rights one day or originalism another day. But what then are those policy outcomes as you view them? What are they really trying to achieve? I mean, you mentioned it's culture wars. Ultimately, what are their objectives that they'll use whatever legal argument they can find in service of?
The Republican Supreme Court wants to repeal the 20th century, and they've largely already succeeded in doing that. Now, as they look forward towards the future, they're trying to repeal the 19th century, at least the part of the 19th century that happened after the Civil War. And that is the simplest way of thinking about it. They want to restore a white supremacist government run by rich white males. That is their fundamental goal. And everybody who doesn't fit into that white male, wealthy, cis heteronormative structure is somebody they think that can be discarded, right? So of course they're attacking voting rights of black and brown people specifically. Of course they're attacking LGBTQ plus rights. They're trying to eradicate trans children. I mean, like, they just don't want trans children to be allowed to exist. They're trying to take away women's rights. They have succeeded in taking away women's fundamental right to reproductive choice, and they're coming for the rest of it. So, like, the entire project doesn't make sense unless you're a person who thinks that 1859 was when America was great. And that is what they are always trying to get back to. People put that on Trump. They put that on MAGA. They put that on this kind of, relatively speaking, recent outcrop, an eruption of white supremacy emanating from the orange president. But you got to understand, this is Roberts's 20th year as Chief Justice. The Supreme Court was at this project long before Trump came down his golden escalator. All right. Mm-hmm. And this is the project that they've been on for 20 years, and they're winning. Like I said, they've already basically succeeded in repealing the 20th century. They're going for the 19th now.
Well, all right. So we're heading back to 1859, and you're listening to Your Call's Media Roundtable. Every Friday is our Media Roundtable show. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're speaking with Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, a wonderful resource for keeping up with the Supreme Court and other important legal developments across the country. And we're also speaking with Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for the publication The Nation, author of two books, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America, and Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. And we're going to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. If you have questions about what's happening with this U.S. Supreme Court, what's on tap with some of these cases that we're going to delve into coming up in this new term, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Chris, I want to talk about some of the specific executive powers that the court is going to be assessing this term. What's sort of top of your list of what you're going to be watching this term in terms of what the Trump administration is going to be trying to argue for?
Yeah, I mean, we have the first case and another example of how the court will move as quickly as Trump wants and as slowly as Trump wants when they want to move slowly is that we're going to be hearing arguments already next month over Trump's tariffs. That obviously is a perfect example of a rule that defined the Supreme Court for the Trump administration, the major questions doctrine, all of a sudden disappearing when it comes to Trump purporting to write the word tariffs into a law that doesn't talk about tariffs in order to dramatically change the global economy, not even the United States economy. Whereas we all remember the court struck down Biden's efforts to eliminate student loan debt because that was a major question that Congress had to specifically address in order for Biden to have that power. So those arguments are going to be on November 5th. We're going to have arguments over this Humphreys executor precedent and the president's ability to fire people, specifically as to the Federal Trade Commission, but then also as to this effort to fire Lisa Cook, the Federal Reserve Board governor, who Trump purported to fire. Now, the Supreme Court has tried again on the shadow docket in a very weird paragraph that I'm sure we all three of us could riff on for a while, that they essentially tried to write in an exception to a shadow docket order over the summer by saying the Fed is different. And Trump, being given a line, said, no, I'm going to cross it. And now we're going to see if even that is going to be a line that the Supreme Court holds. We're going to have cases over these military deployments are quickly making their way up. There was an argument in the Ninth Circuit yesterday over the Oregon National Guard deployment. And I suspect that either that or Illinois or the ongoing dispute over troops in DC or LA is going to reach the Supreme Court eventually. And the birthright citizenship case, the Trump administration has already sought cert in that. I still do think they're going to lose that one, but this might be an example of there being a couple of cases where the justices give a win to history, actual history and tradition of the court's precedents, in order to give Trump wins on a wide range of things that will dramatically and horrifyingly empower him.
Yes. All right. Well, just a few issues then for the Supreme Court to delve into. Nothing too major. I'm, of course, saying that facetiously here. Chris, I appreciate you teeing up all of these issues, and I'm sure there are more that we can delve into. I want to start, though, with the tariff question. This feels like a potentially, you know, monumental kind of case here. I mean, depending on how the court turns out. As you mentioned, the court has been really strict about trying to narrow at least Democratic presidents' authority when they're really trying to read in a lot of power and authority from a statute. I think Scalia had the famous line that Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes, and they were happy to strike down, as you mentioned, the student loan forgiveness piece. They were happy to strike down the Clean Power Plan when the EPA was regulating carbon emissions from power plants based on the Clean Air Act. It seems to me they should be reading the tariff question the same way, that the original statute does not give the president unilateral authority to impose these tariffs. And Ellie, I really want to hear from you on this. What is your reading? How is the court? It seems like, based on what you said, they're going to want to find for Trump that he can continue to impose these tariffs. So how do they kind of, and maybe I'm wrong, we'll see, but how do they wiggle around that? How are they going to be able to find for him having that authority, but at the same time square it somehow with their precedents where they've been so strict on Democratic presidents trying to exercise, well, arguably much less severe authority?
Yeah, so Ethan, the problem there is the premise of your question, that they have to square it. Why do they have to square it? Why do they have to make it fit with their past precedents, right? Like, what? Why? We expect them to, because that's normally how things done, but they don't actually have to make it make sense, you know? They can just say, oh, tariffs are completely different than student loan debt, and so we're going to make a completely contradictory decision. Like, and that's it. They're the Supreme Court. They can say that. Who's going to stop them, right? Another example of that is, even if you look at what they're doing with the Fed and how the court's trying to say that Lisa Cook and the Fed are somehow different than every other person working in the executive branch, because they already gave Trump the authority to fire every other person working for the executive branch except the Fed. What? How does that make sense? It doesn't. The Fed is exactly like every other thing, but they're saying, oh, no, actually, it's super different because it's an like, they make it up. And again, so, like, the idea that they have to square what they're currently doing, what they've done in the past, just doesn't hold water. Now, on the tariff case, on the Fed case, I do think that there is some resistance from the kind of more old school conservatives, the kind of John Roberts types of conservatives, because once you let Trump screw with tariffs and screw with the Fed, you're screwing with their money, right? Mm-hmm. And old school Republicans don't like it when you come after their money. Like, they're happy to allow Trump's craziness to go unchecked when all he's doing is firing black people and bullying trans kids. But when it comes to Republicans' money, they have a different level of concern there. So I do think that there is some desire from the Supreme Court to slow down, to restrict Trump's ability to reshape the entire American economy in whatever crazy MAGA ways he wants to. Yes. And so they might rule against him. They might try to find a way to rule against him in those cases. But again, you got to be able to count to five, right? So let's assume that you've got three liberal justices who don't want Trump to have unquestionable power over the American economy, right? So that gets the other three. And I'm kind of making this up. Let's assume that Roberts is also just one of those old school Republicans who doesn't want Trump to have that kind of power over the economy. That gets you to four. Where's the fifth? Mm-hmm. Where's the fifth to stop this, right? Because the four horsemen, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, they're all in on executive authority, right or wrong, right? They're all in on might makes right. As a legal proposition, right? So now you're really looking at Amy Coney Barrett, and just I would rather build a house on a bed of sand than have to rely on Amy Coney Barrett to do the right thing.
All right. And Chris, just wondering if you briefly want to weigh in on Ellie's take here on what might happen with the tariff case.
No, I think that is a pretty correct assessment. I think that the reality is that this is another example of this, like, you give Trump lines and somehow John Roberts still thinks in 2025 that is not just a request to jump over it. And like you look at the history of how this law has been used, and the only example that anyone can point to is a smaller time-limited tariff by Nixon that led to them changing the law. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when that's your best example, is the guy who got run out of office later, you understand how difficult a case you've got.
Yes. All right. Well, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and what's going to be happening this term. We're joined by Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, and Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation. I'm Ethan Elkind. This is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. Lots more to cover on our program, so stay with us. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show, and you can find out more information on our website. Go to kalw.org, click on news, and you'll see our program listed there. You can also listen to past shows and subscribe to the Your Call podcast on iTunes. And if you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. The new term just began this week. What cases we will be hearing, what types of decisions might be coming down the pike. We're joined by Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, and Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation. And we also want to hear from you. The phone lines are open. Are there any cases that you're particularly interested in that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet, or any aspects of this year's docket that you have questions about for our experts? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And let's go to the phone lines now. We have Greg calling in from Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, I guess just briefly, one case that I might be interested in is just what position they would take on Trump's ability to use the federal troops and the National Guard to go in and allegedly deal with these war zones in these major cities. But to me, that's not the important issue. I think the issue really is, this court, at least the majority in this court, has no credibility. They've totally lost their credibility, and it's deplorable that it's gotten to this point. But I mean, I don't know how the Democrats or anybody is going to be able to stop them from doing what they're doing. And these people have lifetime appointments. They have no legitimacy at this point, but they're going to continue to serve. So I have no idea how you change this. I mean, going forward. I'd be curious to hear what your guests have to say.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. Ellie, it sounds like a question that tees you up perfectly, so I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, Greg, I got an idea of how you stop this. You stop this by expanding the court. This number of 9 justices is not set by the Constitution. It is set by simple legislation. You can expand the number of justices on the court with a bill that starts in the House, is passed by the Senate, and signed by the president. And you can have as many Supreme Court justices as you want. And the way that you stop the conservatives is that when the Democrats get in power, when the Democrats hold all three, the House, the Senate, and the White House, like they did in 2021, you expand the court so you drown out, you turn the 6 conservative majority into a 10-6 conservative minority, right? Or a 13-6, or whatever. Pick a number. There's no number too big for me, right? And that is how you stop them. And if the Supreme Court, you said they've lost legitimacy and credibility. What do they care? People are still following their rulings. What do they care about their legitimacy and credibility right now? They don't have independent enforcement power, but Trump is going to do anything that they rule on that helps Trump. He's not going to do anything that doesn't help Trump, but that's a decision that they're not going to have to deal with, right? So the one of the reasons why they seem so if I will, drunk on their own power, is because they know that the Democrats don't have the will or strength or political gumption to do anything about it to stop them. If they feared that a Democratic administration coming in would significantly cut their own power, they might be behaving differently right now. But they understand, they smell the weakness of the Democratic Party. And so they have no, there are no restraints on them. If the Supreme Court honestly thought that the next Democratic president would come in and blow up their institution, expand the court, take away lifetime appointments, and significantly reduce their power, we'd be dealing with a different Supreme Court right now.
But Ellie, it's not just the U.S. president. It would take a trifecta, right? It would take pretty serious majorities in the Congress as well, right?
It would take, no, take 2021. Because I'm one of those people who does not pretend that the filibuster is a constitutional requirement. The filibuster is a tradition that can be gotten rid of at the drop of a hat whenever Democrats get their act together. So yeah, it does take a trifecta like you had in 2021 and 2022. It is literally that simple. And I understand politically, it sounds like, oh, like what a heavy lift. It is constitutionally speaking that simple. And just to finish this point, it is easier. People don't understand this always. It is easier to expand the court than to take away lifetime appointments, because lifetime appointments are there by constitutional mandate, right? Like that is literally Article 3 of the Constitution. These people serve while in good behavior. So if you're gonna change lifetime appointments significantly, you really have to get in there and come up with a 28th Amendment, which takes 3/4 of the states to ratify, and yada, yada. That's a difficult political lift. Yeah. Expanding the number of justices from 9 and 19, I suggest 29, that's a piece of legislation. That can be 218 votes in the House, 51 votes in the Senate, and signed by the president, and you're done.
Yes. Chris Geithner, I want to let you, well, first of all, weigh in on what Ellie's sort of solution here might be, but also I wanted to follow up on Greg's question around the case about military deployment, National Guard deployment in the states, and what you would foresee it with that case percolating through the Supreme Court here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a reality that John Roberts is creating for himself. He could have chosen a path that would have required the court to adhere more to principles and prevent prevent the expansion of the court increasingly being seen as the only way of addressing the quasi-permanent harm it is causing. But he didn't choose that. And to the contrary, he has chosen to go along with most of the majority's efforts to create an unworkable, unbalanced federal government, not to mention, as you mentioned at the top of the show, also unbalanced as to regarding state power. And to segue perfectly into the issue of this wild, brazen, purposeless and ultimately lawless effort to send troops into American cities. The fact of the matter is that we've seen, I think, Judge Immergut's decision over the weekend out of Oregon was stark. She was a Trump appointee from his first presidency, and she laid out the fact that they're just this is the phrase that she used was that his decision was untethered to reality. That was the case. And now when we got up to the Ninth Circuit, we saw what the problem is that we will face at the Supreme Court when two Trump appointees were Judge Nelson and Judge Beatty were very skeptical of Immergut's order and suggested that this statute 10 USC 12406, that is the law that Trump has used to activate, call up the National Guard, federalize the National Guard, that they essentially said that we have to defer to how Trump and his people think things are on the ground. And if when they go back into their chambers and come up with a decision that essentially says that, and if that is the direction that the Supreme Court goes, I think we will be in a very, very dangerous position as to not only this, but also remember that similar questions are still on appeal and being considered regarding his efforts to invoke the Alien Enemies Act. Mm-hmm. With this, like, if Trump says that he believes something, and there's lots of evidence, facts, clear images, videos, reality to the contrary, does it matter?
Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see how this whole sort of federal incursion into states' rights, how this will play out in the Supreme Court. If you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind. This is our Your Call Friday Media Roundtable special. You're listening to three lawyers talk about the U.S. Supreme Court and what's happening and what's going to happen with this term coming up. We're joined by Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, and Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation. Phone lines are open if you have questions about potential Supreme Court reform or questions about particular cases that you might be interested in. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email with any questions you have or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. We have Parker dialing in from San Francisco. Parker, welcome to Your Call.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate your guests, and especially Ellie. I really appreciate the way you're just so clearly articulating what this conservative movement has become and the goals of this conservative movement. So one of the things I have a question about, you know, we're talking about Democratic weakness and kind of, you know, how they're not really able to get their act together. I mean, the conservatives, they have like the Heritage Foundation, right? I mean, they put together like lists of judges for Trump to handpick that were supposed to help guide this kind of agenda. What is the corrective for, you know, the progressive side of this? Do we start putting together that kind of, you know, project where we essentially say that, like, these are simply policies that we think need to be happened, and we're going to just put people in who are willing to make those policies happen regardless of this kind of precedent? Or what is sort of the alternative, I guess? Because I completely agree. I think at this point they're essentially going off lies to help push forward their political agenda. And what I'm trying to understand is kind of like, what do we do to you know, rebut that kind of thing? To me, it feels like you have to frankly fight it with significant power and significant decision-making where you're willing to take those kinds of like drastic steps, because that's what the conservative movement has been doing for the past 25, 30 plus like years, right? I mean, that's what they've reshaped themselves as. So that's my general question. Thank
you. We saw Mitch McConnell, you know, stonewall and prevent a Democratic president from getting his pick on the Supreme Court with Merrick Garland back in 2016. Parker, I think your question is a good one for Ellie. Ellie, what's the sort of progressive response? Can they steal from the conservative playbook here?
Yeah, well, it is a great question, Parker, and I get asked that a lot. And yes, absolutely. The liberals need a response to the Heritage Foundation, to the Federal Society, with our own organizations, with our own judge-picking, judge-making machines. It starts in law school. You have to understand that if you are a conservative at a top law school, somebody will come to you and map out the rest of your career. Tell you which judge to clerk for, tell you which firms to work for, and put you in the position so that when you're 30, you're a district court judge, when you're 40, you're an appellate judge. And, you know, if you do well, if you do right by them, you might be in a position to be a Supreme Court judge. Liberals got nothing like that. Now, I am a member, I'm a board member of Demand Justice, which tries to do some of this work. I work a lot with the American Constitutional Society, there are a lot of organizations on our side that try to do some of this, but there are two things that people don't understand about the asymmetrical war here. One, it's kind of obvious, money. The conservative big money donors pour tons of money into creating a Supreme Court that is doing what it's doing right now, right? Like, if you go find a rich conservatives, they are willing to put money into the courts. That's just not true on the Democratic side. We want to put our money in candidates. We want to put our money in different places. We have not focused on putting our money, our big donor money, into controlling the Supreme Court. So that's one way that we're losing the battle. The other way is a little bit more subtle. And the way that I've tried to explain this is, imagine that some rich Democratic person gives me $1 billion and says, Ellie, you go out there and you be Leonard Leo, right? You pick all of our judges, right? Now, that's great. I can spend $1 billion pretty easily, right? But you gotta understand, when Leo does it, he's talking to fundamentally the same guy. Right. When he goes and talks to all the conservative constituencies, the gun lobby, you know, Leo goes to the gun lobby. He's like, I'm going to pick all the judges. The gun lobby's like, great. Right. Then he goes to the religious right. I'm going to pick all the judges. Religious right are like, great, because their interests are almost always aligned. Now, imagine if I do that. Right. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to pick all the judges. So Democratic senators, just listen to me. I'm going to pick the judges. Let's say Dick Durbin says OK to that, which he won't. But let's just pretend for a second. Right. Then I got to go to the NAACP and say, hey, I'm going to pick all the judges. And maybe the NAACP says OK. But then I got to go to Lombada Legal and be, hey, I'm not actually gay, but I'm an ally. And by the way, I'm going to pick all the judges. If you have a suggestion, put it in the box. Hey, Voto Latino. I can't speak Spanish, but I'm going to pick all of our judges now. So just put your suggestion in the box and I'll handle it. Hey, NARAL, you know, I'm going to pick all the judges because I love abortion. At some point, these people are going to laugh me out of their office. They're going to be like, who the hell are you? Democrats are, it's like Little League baseball. Everybody needs a turn at bat. And so it's very hard to get one centralized organization to do all the judge making for all of the big tent constituencies on the progressive and liberal. I haven't talked about the difference between liberals and neoliberals and progressives, but like, I can't walk in to both AOC's office and be like, I'm gonna pick all the judges, and Elisa Slotkin's office and be like, I'm gonna pick all the judges, and have both of them agree, oh yeah, Ellie's got it. Like, that's just not gonna happen, right? It does happen on the conservative side, and that's another reason why liberals lose the war. To win the war, to overcome this fundamental asymmetry, what needs to start happening is that we have to start in the primary season electing Democrats to, especially the Senate, who are going to take the courts seriously. We do a horrible job about that. I mentioned earlier about how Biden had the trifecta and did not do court reform. That is, in fairness, what he promised during the campaign. Biden, of all the Democrats that were running in 2020, including the coffee man, including Mayor Stop and Frisk, Biden was the least amenable to reforming the courts, and it didn't cost him a vote. Yeah. It didn't cost him anything to be the least interested in reforming the Supreme Court. Until that changes, nothing changes.
Yes. All right. We're speaking with Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation, and Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, here on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. Phone lines are open, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And we have Maurice dialing in from Oakland. Maurice, welcome to Your Call.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Regarding the trifecta, I believe the White House is attempting to militarize the Justice Department and, by extension, the vote in 2026. Regarding Ellie's supposition that once the Democrats regain the trifecta, they'll be able to expand the court. By that time, the Republic will be relegated to the ash heap of history. Ellie, what about the interim? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Maurice. Ellie, please respond.
Yeah, I don't got a great answer for you, Maurice. Just like I am operating under the idea that we will still have fair, free and fair elections in 2026 and 2028. And that is kind of a naive position, right? That is a princess bride, hope, you know, power of friendship position. I don't know that that's actually going to happen. I don't know that we actually have a free and fair election in 2026 and 2028. What I do feel, and Chris, I feel like you're living in D.C. You're actually in a better position to judge this than I am. I do feel that there is some sense of overreach, that the militarization, the attacks on cities, that's a bit of an overreach. The Supreme Court just wilding out and being drunk on its own power, that's a sense of overreach. And if they keep overreaching, maybe the people rise, right? And so I go from kind of like being very naive and legalistic about it to being very like, you know, Gavroche in Les Miserables, like, you know, when will the people rise up and do something about this government? That is my, frankly, best answer about what we do in the interim.
Well, Chris, I know you've been patiently waiting here. I'm sure you have thoughts to jump in. And what are your thoughts specifically on this sort of question of despair? You know, people getting very gloomy about the future of democracy, about whether or not, you know, the executive branch is going to abide by judicial branch decisions. What's your response to people who raise these kinds of concerns?
Oh, Ethan, thank you. Someone who clearly follows my work. give me a softball right across the plate. I think it is so important to understand that, like, for all of the horrors that we have seen this year, we have also seen such incredible success at pushing back and at what happens when you do push back. And to Ellie's point, what happens to the American people writ large when people do stand up and push back? Like, I mean, the fact that for all of their assertions of great power and this expansive executive, the fact of the matter is that we can really, for all that people say that, like, they're not going to follow court orders and stuff, like, around the edges, there are questions about, like, are they narrowly interpreting orders or not? But as we know as lawyers, that's always going to happen. Really, there are, like, a handful of, we know what they are, situations where there is an argument that they didn't follow a court order. And that's the March 15th flights, that's Abrego Garcia, and that's the third country removals, taking people to a country that they did not initially, were not from or don't have legal status in. Mm-hmm. And in those three instances, the administration has been forced to spend literal months in court defending themselves. And regardless of whether the U.S. Supreme Court and the conservative majority there gives Trump his way to do what he wants, in the interim, what has happened with all of those situations is that public opinion has turned against the Trump administration. And the fact that Trump has found a way to make Republicans underwater in polls on immigration is astounding. That is if we had a proper media system, like, that would be the pivotal front page daily reminder that the Trump administration is failing America. And the fact that we don't and we just move on shows the media problems. But the reality is that those court challenges and just saying no, just when they do something illegal, saying no, making them go to court if they want to actually do something. And then if they do something wrong, challenging them has slowed down their role so much on so many fronts that's the way that we get to a 2026 and 2028 where we have elections that can actually address this.
Yes. So the guardrail may be teetering a bit, but still there to some extent. Chris, I can't let you go without asking about cases affecting LGBTQ people's lives. I know that's a big focus of your work, and we only have a few minutes left. So just briefly, anything you want to highlight for this term coming up?
Yeah, I mean, we already heard this week, it's unusual to have such a high profile case right up, but we had Childs versus Salazar over Colorado's conversion therapy ban. And it truly was a lopsided argument. It appears that the ban is going to be struck down. And I think the only silver lining to that is that there did seem to be an effort by Justice Kagan to make sure that whatever does come out will be as much as a rule that does actually apply across the board and is not just a you can't have pro-LGBT laws, but you can have anti-LGBTQ mm-hmm. laws. In addition to that, we also are going to have multiple specific challenges to anti-trans laws and policies. The court has already granted cert in two cases over anti-trans sports bans, and the Supreme Court has on the shadow docket now the Trump administration asking to be able to enforce Marco Rubio's anti-trans and anti-non-binary passport policy while that litigation is ongoing.
Right, I just want to really quickly jump in.
Please do,
Chris, just to point out that while, and even in our conversation, we've been so focused on Trump and the Supreme Court's relationship to him. Please, Democrats, make no mistake. While the Supreme Court is giving Trump everything that he wants, their long-term, again, 20-year goal from the Roberts Courts is to destroy this community. Is to destroy, literally eradicate trans kids and destroy LGBTQ rights. And that happens regardless of whether or not they say boo to Trump, right? Like, while Democrats are kind of waiting for the magical day where the Supreme Court stands up to Trump, all of this terrible stuff is happening, not even beneath the surface, right out front. As Chris said, it was their first case coming back from summer break. To legalize conversion therapy. This is the civil rights challenge of this term is what they're doing to the LGBTQ community. And despite what Democratic consultants might say, I don't think that we can ignore or forget about that or abandon people to the slings and arrows of outrageous cis-hetero culture.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap. We obviously need another hour. Have to have both of you back on, but I just want to thank you both for coming on. Chris Geidner, publisher and author of Law Dork, and Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation, with the books Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America, and Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Thank you both so much for coming on Your Call today.
Thanks for having us.